I take her hand in mine and walk, shooting a dark look at the trees. Just because Izzy is dead doesn't mean her thoughts should be eavesdropped upon. To my surprise, the whispers cease, as if the ghosts wish to give us our privacy. "Are you scared that it will hurt?" I say. She looks down at her booted feet.
"I don't have family, Elias. I only had Cook, and she's not dead. What if there's no one waiting for me? What if I'm alone?"
"I don't think it's like that," I say. Through the trees I see the sparkle of sun on water. "There's no alone or together on that side. I think it's different."
"How do you know?"
"I don't," I say. "But the spirits can't move on until they've dealt with whatever ties them to the living world. Love or anger, fear or family. So maybe those emotions don't exist on that side. In any case, it will be better than this place, Izzy. This place is haunted. You don't deserve to be stuck here." I spy a path ahead, and my body moves to it instinctively. I think of a pale-feathered hummingbird that once hatched in Quinn's courtyard. How it would disappear in winter and return in the spring, guided home by some unknowable compass within. "But why do you know this path, Elias, when you've never been to this part of the forest before?" I brush away the question. Now is not the time for it. Izzy leans on me as the path leads down to an embankment padded with dried leaves. The trail drops suddenly, and we step down. A slow river whispers at our feet.
"Is this it?"
She gazes out at the clear water. The strange, muted sun of the waiting place shines in her blonde hair, making it appear almost white.
"Is this where I go on?"
I nod, the answer coming to me as if I've always known it. "I won't leave until you're ready," I say. "I'll stay with you." She lifts her dark eye to my face, looking a bit more like her old self again.
"What becomes of you, Elias?"
I shrug. "I'm fine, good, alive. Alone," I blurt out. Immediately, I feel like a fool. Izzy tilts her head and puts a ghostly hand to my face.
"Sometimes, Elias," she says, "loneliness is a choice."
She fades at the edges, bits of her disappearing as delicately as dandelion fluff.
"Tell Lyra I wasn't afraid. She was worried."
She releases me and steps into the river. One moment she is there, the next she is not. Gone before I even raise a hand in farewell. Something lightens within me at her departure, as if a bit of the guilt that plagues me has melted away. Behind me, I sense another presence. Memories on the air. The clash of practice sims, foot races in the dunes, his laughter at the endless teasing about Alia. "You could let go too." I don't turn. "You could be free, like her. I'll help you. You don't have to do it alone." I wait. I hope. But Tristus's only response is silence. The next 3 days are the worst in my life. If my seizures take me to the waiting place, I am unaware of it. All I know is pain and the warden's white blue eyes as he bombards me with questions.
"Do tell me about your mother. Such a fascinating woman. You were dear friends with the Bloodshrike. Does she feel others' pain as keenly as you do?"
Tass, his little face worried, tries to keep my wounds clean.
"I can help you, Elias. The Skiritae can help."
Drusius softens me up every morning for the warden. "We'll never let you get the best of me again, You bastard. In whatever bits of lucidity I have left, I gather what information I can. Don't give up, Elias. Don't fall into the dark. I listen to the guards' footsteps, the timbre of their voices. I learn to identify them by the little bits of shadow that pass by my door. I figure out their rotations and identify a pattern in the interrogations. Then I search for an opportunity. None appears. Instead, death circles, a patient vulture. I feel his crooked shadow approaching, chilling the air I breathe. Not yet. Then one morning, footsteps thud outside my door and keys rattle. Drusius enters my cell to give me my daily beating, right on schedule. I let my head loll and my mouth hang open. He chuckles to himself and saunters forward. When he's inches away from me, he grabs me by my hair and makes me look at him. Pathetic! He spits in my face. Swine. I thought you were supposed to be strong. The almighty Elias Veturius. You're nothing. Stupid man. You forgot to tighten my chains. I drive my knee up, straight between his legs. He squeaks and doubles over, and I chase the blow with a brain-jarring headbutt. His eyes go glassy, and he doesn't notice that I've wrapped one of my chains around his neck until his face is already turning blue. You! I snarl at him when he finally passes out. Talk too damn much! I let him down and search his body for keys. I find them and clap my manacles on him in case he wakes up before I want him to. Then I gag him. I peer out the slats of the door. The other mask on duty hasn't yet come looking for Drusius, but he will soon enough. I count the sound of that mask's footsteps until I'm certain he's well away from me. Then I slip out the door. The light of the torches stings my eyes, and I squint. My cell is at the end of a short hallway that branches out from the main hallway of the block. This hall has only three cells, and I'm certain that the one next to me is empty, which leaves only one other cell to check. My fingers are useless from the torture, and I grit my teeth at the long seconds it takes to pour through the keys. Hurry, Elias, hurry! Finally, I find the right key, and moments later, I unlock the door. It squeals wildly, and I turn sideways to squeeze through. It squeals again when I close it, and I curse softly. Though I was only in the torchlight for a moment, it takes my eyes a bit to adjust to the darkness. At first, I cannot see the drawings. When I do, my breath catches. Tass was right. They do look as if they'll come to life. The cell is silent. Darin must be sleeping, or unconscious. I take a step toward the emaciated form in the corner. Then I hear the rattle of chains, the pant of harsh breath. A ravaged spectre leaps from the darkness, his face inches from my own, bony fingers around my neck. His light hair is missing in chunks from his head. His bruised face is crisscrossed with scars. Two of his fingers are stubs, and his torso is covered in burns. 10 hells. Who in the bleeding skies, the spectre says, are you? I remove his hands easily from my neck, but for a second I can't speak. It's him. I know it instantly. Not because he resembles Lyra. Even in the dim cell I can see his eyes are blue, his skin pale. But the fire in his gaze. I've only ever seen that in one other person. And though I expect his eyes to be mad, judging from the sounds I've heard, they appear completely sane. Darin of Serra, I say. I'm a friend. He responds with a dark chuckle.
A marshal as a friend? I think not.
I look over my shoulder at the door. We have no time. I know your sister, Lyra, I say. I'm here to break you out at her request. We need to go. Now.
You're a liar!
He hisses. The echo of a footstep outside. Then silence. We don't have time for this. I can prove it to you, I say. Ask me about her. I can tell you.
You can tell me what I told the warden, which is bleeding
everything about her.
No stone unturned, he said.
Darren glares at me with a searing hatred. He must be exaggerating his pain during interrogations so that the warden believes he is weak, because from that look, it's obvious he's no pushover. Normally I'd approve, but right now it's damned inconvenient.
Listen to me.
I keep my voice low but sharp enough to cut through his suspicion.
I'm not one of them, or else I wouldn't be dressed like this and with wounds of my own.
I bare my arms, marked with cuts from the warden's latest interrogation.
I'm a prisoner.
I broke in to get you out, but I was caught. Now I have to break us both out.
What does he want with her?
Darren snarls at me.
Tell me what he wants with my sister, and maybe I'll believe you.
I don't know, I say. Likely he wants to get into your head. Get to know you by asking about her. If you're not answering his questions about the weapons...
He hasn't asked any questions about the bleeding weapons.
Darren runs a claw across his scalp.
All he's asked about is her.
That doesn't make any sense, I say. You were captured because of the weapons, because of what Spiro taught you about Serik Steel. Darren goes still.
How the hells do you know that?
I told you.
I've never told any of them that, he says. As far as they know, I'm a resistance spy.
Skies,
do you have Spiro too?
Wait.
I hold up a hand, baffled. He's never questioned you about the weapons, only about Lyra. Darren juts his chin out and snorts.
He must be even more desperate for information than I thought. Did he really think you could convince me that you were a friend of Lyra's? Tell him one other thing about her, from me. Lyra would never ask a marshal for help.
Footsteps pass in the main hallway. We need to get the hell out of here. Did you tell them how your sister sleeps with her hand on your mother's armlet? I ask. Or that up close, her eyes are gold and brown and green and silver? Or that since the day you told her to run, all she has felt is guilt, and all she has thought about is somehow getting to you? Or that she has a fire inside her that's more than a match for any mask, if only she's willing to believe in it? Darren's mouth gapes open.
Who are you?
I told you, I say. I'm a friend. And right now, I need to get us out of here. Can you stand? Darren nods, limping forward. I put his arm around my shoulders. We shuffle to the door, and I hear the approaching footsteps of a guard. I can tell from the gate that it's a legionnaire. They're always louder than the masks. I wait impatiently for him to pass.
What did the warden ask about your sister?
I say as we wait.
He wanted to know everything,
Darren says darkly.
But he felt around for the information. He was frustrated. It was as if he wasn't quite sure what to ask, as if the questions weren't his to begin with. I tried to lie at first, but he always knew.
What did you tell him? The guard is well away now. I reach for the door handle and pull it open with painful slowness, lest it creak.
Whatever I could to make the pain stop. Stupid things. That she loves the moon festival. That she could watch kites fly for hours.
that she likes her tea with enough honey in it to choke a bear. The pit of my stomach drops away. Those words are familiar. Why are they familiar? I turn my attention to Darren in full, and he looks at me uncertainly.
I didn't think it would help him, he says. He never seemed satisfied, no matter what I told him. Anything I said, he'd demand more.
It's a coincidence, I tell myself. Then I remember something Grandfather Quinn used to say. Only a jackass believes in coincidence. Darren's words swirl in my head, linking to things I don't want them to, drawing lines where there should not be any. Did you tell the warden that Lyra loves lentil stew in the winter? I ask. That it made her feel safe? Or that she didn't want to die without seeing the great library of Edessa?
I used to tell her about the library all the time, Darren says. She loved hearing about it.
Words float through my head. Snippets of conversation between Lyra and Keenan overheard as we traveled.
I've been flying kites since I was a boy, he'd once said. I could watch them for hours. I would love to see the Great Library one day.
And Lyra, that night before I left, smiling as she drank the too sweet tea that Keenan handed her.
Good tea is sweet enough to choke a bear, he'd said.
No, bleeding hells, no! All that time, lurking among us, pretending to care about her, trying to get in good with Izzy, acting like a friend when he was really a tool of the warden. And his face before I left. That hardness that he never showed to Lyra, but that I sensed was there from the beginning.
I know what it is to do things for the people you love.
Damn it all! He must have told the warden of my arrival. Though how he could have gotten a message to the old man without using the drums is beyond me.
I tried not to tell him anything important, Darren says. I thought...
Darren falls silent at the sharp voices of approaching soldiers. I close the door, and we back up into Darren's cell until they pass. Only they don't pass. Instead, they turn down the hallway leading to this cell. As I cast about for some way to defend myself, the door flies open and four masks pour in, truncheons raised. It's not a fight. They're too fast, and I am injured, poisoned and starved. I drop. I know when I'm outnumbered, and I can't withstand any more serious injuries. The masks desperately want to use those truncheons to pound my head in, but they don't, instead cuffing me roughly and yanking me to my feet. The warden strolls in, hands behind his back. When he sees Darren and me confined next to each other, he doesn't appear surprised.
Excellent, Elias, he murmurs. Finally, you and I have something worthwhile to discuss.
Chapter 42 Helene. The red-headed scholar reaches for his sim, but halts at the simultaneous hiss of two blades leaving their scabbards. With a slight shift of weight, he eases himself in front of Lyra. She sidesteps him, her glare formidable. She is not the same frightened child I healed in Blackcliff's slaves' quarters. That bizarre protectiveness grips me, the same emotion I felt for Elias and Ner. I reach out and touch her face. She starts, and Arvitas and Pharos exchange a glance. Immediately I pull away, but not before I discern from the touch that she is well. Relief sweeps through me. And anger. Did my healing mean nothing to you? She had a strange song, this girl, with a fey beauty that raised the hair on the back of my neck. So different from Elias's song, but not discordant. Livia and Hannah took singing lessons, What would they call it? Counter-melody. Lyre and Elias are each other's counter-melodies. I am just a dissonant note. I know you're here for your brother, I say. Darren of Sarah, resistance spy. He's not a... I wave off her protestations. I don't bleeding care. You'll probably end up dead. I assure you I won't. The girl's gold eyes spark, and her jaw is set. I made it here, despite the fact that you were hunting us. She takes a step forward, but I give no ground. I survived the Commandant's genocide. A few patrols to round up rebels is not... Patrols? Her face twists in horror. You're killing thousands! Women! Children! You bastards have an entire skies-forsaken army parked in the Argent Hills! Enough! The redhead says sharply, but I ignore him. My mind is fixed on what Lyre just said. An entire bleeding army.
The Beach of Blackcliff is planning something. It's big this time, girl.
I need to get out of here. A hunch has taken root in my mind, and I need to consider it. I am here for Veturius. Any attempt to rescue him will result in your death. Rescue, Lyre says flatly. From the prison. Yes, I say impatiently. I don't want to kill you, girl, so stay out of my way. I stride from the cave into the heavy snowdrifts, mind churning. Shrike, Varys says, when we've nearly reached our camp. Don't take off my head, but we can't just leave them alive to carry out an illegal prison break. Every garrison we went to in the tribal lands was short on soldiers, I say. Even Antium didn't have a full complement of guards for the walls. Why do you think that is? Varys shrugs, bewildered. The men were sent to the borderlands. Dex heard the same. But my father told me in his letters that the border garrisons needed reinforcements. He said the Commandant requested soldiers too. Everyone is short. Dozens of garrisons. Thousands of soldiers. An army of soldiers.
You mean what the girl said about the Argent Hills? Varys scoffs. She's a scholar. She doesn't know what she's talking about.
The hills have a dozen valleys big enough to hide an army in, I say. And only one pass in and one pass out. Both of those passes.
Avitas swears. Blocked, he says. By the weather. But those passes are never blocked so early in winter.
We were in such a hurry we didn't think twice about it, Varys says. If there is an army, what is it for? Marcus might be planning to attack the tribal lands, I say, or Marin. Both options are disastrous. The Empire has enough to deal with without a full-scale war. We reach our camp, and I hand Varys the reins to his horse. Find out what's going on. Scout the Argent Hills. I ordered Dex back to Antium. Have him keep the Blackguard at the ready. Farris's eyes shift to Avitas, and he tilts his head at me. You trust him? I'll be all right, I say. Go! Moments after he leaves, a shadow steps out from the woods. My sim is half-drawn when I realize it's a fiver, trembling and half-frozen. He silently hands me a note. The Commandant arrives this evening to oversee the cleansing of Koff Prison's scholar population. She and I will meet at midnight in her pavilion. Avitas grimaces at the look on my face. What is it? The Warden, I say, coming out to play. By midnight, I ghost along the base of Koff's high outer wall toward the Commandant's camp, eyeing the friezes and gargoyles that make Koff almost ornate when compared to Blackcliff. Avitas follows, covering our tracks. Caeris Veturia has erected her tents in the shadow of Koff's southeast wall. Her men walk the perimeter, and her pavilion sits at the center of the camp, with 5 yards of clear space on 3 sides. The tent backs to Koff's ice-slick walls.
No woodpiles, no wagons, not even a bleeding horse to use as cover. I stop along the far edge of the camp and nod to Arvatas. He takes out a grappling hook and heaves it at a pinnacle atop a buttress about 40 feet up. The hook catches. He hands me the rope and silently backtracks through the snow. When I'm 10 feet up, I hear the crunch of boots on snow. I turn, expecting to whisper shout at Arvatas for being so damned loud. Instead, a soldier lumbers out from between the tents, unbuttoning his pants to relieve himself. I scramble for a knife, but my boots, slick with snow, slip on the rope, and I drop the blade. The soldier whirls at the sound. His eyes widen, and he gathers his breath to shout, "Damn it!" I prepare to drop, but an arm wraps around the soldier's throat, choking off his air. Arvatas glares up at me as he grapples with the man. "Go," he mouths. Swiftly, I snake the rope between my boots and pull myself up, hand over hand. Once at the top, I take aim at a second pinnacle, 30 feet away, directly over the commandant's tent. I let the grappling hook fly. When I'm certain it's secure, I tie the rope around my waist and take a deep breath, preparing to drop. Then I look down. The stupidest bleeding thing you could have done, Aquila. Freezing wind whips at me, but sweat rolls down my back anyway. Don't retch. Commandant wouldn't thank you for spewing sick all over the top of her tent. My mind flashes to the second trial, to Elias's ever-smiling mouth and silver eyes as he roped himself to me. "I won't let you fall. I promise." But he's not here. I'm alone, perched like a spider over an abyss. I grab the rope, test it one last time, and jump. Weightlessness, terror. My body slams into the wall. I swing wildly. "You're dead, Aquila." Then I center myself, hoping the commandant didn't hear my scrabbling from her tent. I rappel down, slipping easily into the narrow dark space between the tent and Koff's wall. "And I both serve the same master, Warden. His time has come. Give me your influence." "If our master wanted my aid, he would have asked for it. This is your plot, Karis, not his." The Warden's voice is flat, but its toneless boredom hides a deep wariness. He was not nearly so careful when he and I spoke. "Poor Warden," the Commandant says, "so loyal, and yet always the last to know of our master's plans. How it must rankle you that he chose me as the instrument of his will." "It will rankle me more if your plan jeopardizes all we have worked for. Do not take this risk, Karis. He will not thank you for it." "I am speeding the pace at which we carry out his will." "You are furthering your own will." "The Nightbringer has been gone for months." The Commandant's chair scrapes back. "Perhaps he wishes for us to do something useful, instead of awaiting his orders like fivers facing their first battle." "We're running out of time, Caecilius. Marcus has garnered fear, if not respect, from the Gens after the Shrike's display on Cardium Rock."
"You mean, after she foiled your plot to foment this end?"
"The plot would have succeeded," Karis says, "if you had helped me."
"Don't make the same mistake this time. With the Shrike out of the way..." "Not yet, you hag. Marcus is still vulnerable. If you would simply..."
"Secrets are not slaves, Karis. They are not meant to be used and cast aside. I will deploy them with patience and precision, or I will not deploy them at all. I must consider your request."
"Consider quickly." The Commandant's voice takes on the soft edge known to send men scurrying away in fear.
My men will march on Antium in 3 days and arrive on Rathana. I must leave by morning. I cannot claim my throne if I'm not leading my own army. I put my fist in my mouth to keep from gasping. My men, my throne, my army. Finally, the pieces fall into place. The soldiers ordered to report elsewhere, leaving garrisons empty. The lack of men in the countryside. The troop shortage on the embattled borders of the Empire. It all leads back to her. That army in the Argent Hills doesn't belong to Marcus. It belongs to the Commandant. And in less than a week, she's going to use it to murder him and declare herself Empress.
Chapter 43. Liar. The moment the blood strike is out of earshot, I turn to Keenan. I'm not leaving Elias, I say. If Helene gets her hands on him, he'll go straight to Antium for execution. Keenan grimaces. Liar, he says. It might be too late for that. There is nothing stopping her from walking in and taking custody of him. He lowers his voice. Perhaps we should focus on Darren. I will not leave Elias to die at her hands, I say. Not when I'm the only reason he's in Koff in the first place. Forgive me, Keenan says. But the poison will take Elias soon, in any case. So you'd leave him to torture and public execution? I know Keenan has never liked Elias, but I did not think the animosity ran this deep. The lamplight flickers and Keenan runs a hand through his hair, brow furrowed. He kicks a few damp leaves out of the way and gestures for me to sit. We can get him out too, I argue. We just have to move fast and find a way in. I don't think Aquila can just walk in and take him out. She would have already done it if that were the case. She wouldn't have bothered to talk to us. I roll out Elias's map, dirt-stained and faded now. This cave, I point to a spot Elias marked on the map. It's north of the prison. But perhaps we could get inside. We'd need fire powder for that, Keenan says. We have none. Fair enough. I point to another path marked on the north side of the prison, but Keenan shakes his head. That route is blocked, according to the information I have, which is from 6 months ago. Elias was last here 6 years ago. We stare at the parchment, and I point to the west side of the prison where Elias marked a path. What about this? There are sewers here, and it's exposed, yes, but if I could make myself invisible, like I did during the raid... Keenan looks at me sharply. Have you been working at that again? When you should have been resting? When I don't answer, he groans. Skies, liar! We need all of our wits to pull this off. You're exhausting yourself trying to harness something you don't understand. Something unreliable. Sorry, I mumble. If all my practice actually amounted to something, then perhaps I could argue that the risk of exhaustion was worth it. And yes, a few times, while Keenan was on watch or off scouting, I felt like I almost grasped that strange, tingling feeling that meant no one could see me. But as soon as I'd open my eyes and look down, I'd see that I'd failed again. We eat in silence, and when we're done, Keenan stands. I scramble to my feet. I'm going to go scout the prison, he says. I'll be gone for a few hours. Let me see what I can come up with. I'll go with. Easier for me to scout alone, liar, he says. At the irritated look on my face, he takes my hand and draws me close. Trust me, he says against my hair. His warmth eases away the cold that seems to have taken up residence in my bones. It'll be better this way. And don't worry. He pulls away, his dark eyes searing. I'll find us a way in. I promise. Try to rest while I'm gone. We'll need all our strength in the next few days. After he leaves, I organize our limited belongings, sharpen all of my weapons, and practice the little that Keenan had a chance to teach me. The desire to try again to discover my power pulls at me, but Keenan's warning echoes in my head. Unreliable. As I unfurl my bedroll, the hilt of one of Elias's sims catches my eye. I gingerly pull the weapons from their hiding spot. As I examine the sims, a chill runs through me. So many souls sundered from the earth at the edges of these blades, some on my behalf. It's eerie to think of it, and yet I find the Sims offer a strange sort of comfort. They feel like Elias. Perhaps because I am so used to seeing them poking up behind his head in that familiar V. How long since I saw him reaching back for those Sims at the first hint of a threat? How long since I heard his baritone urging me on or drawing a laugh from me? Only 6 weeks, but it feels like much longer. I miss him. When I think of what will happen to him at Helene's hands, my blood boils in rage. If I were the one dying of nightweed poisoning, the one chained in a prison, the one facing torture and death, Elias would not acquiesce. He would find a way to save me. The Sims go back into their scabbards, the scabbards back into their hiding place. I drop into my bedroll with no intention of sleeping. One more time, I think to myself. If it doesn't work, I'll leave it, like Keenan asked. But I owe Elias at least this. As I close my eyes and try to forget myself, I think about Izzy, about how she would blend into the Commandant's house like a chameleon, unseen, unheard. She was soft-footed and soft-spoken, and she heard and saw everything. Perhaps this is not just about a state of mind, but about my body, about finding the quiet version of myself, the Izzy-like version of myself. Disappear, smoke into cold air, and Izzy with her hair in front of her eyes, and a mask moving stealthily through the night. Quiet mind, quiet body. I keep each word distinct, even when my mind begins to tire. And then I feel it, a tingling, first at the tip of my finger. Inhale, exhale, don't let it go. The tingling spreads to my arms, my torso, my legs, my head. I open my eyes, look down, and nearly whoop for joy. Because it's worked. I've done it. I've disappeared. When Keenan returns to the cave hours later, a bundle tucked under his arm, I jump to my feet, and he sighs. "No rest then, I assume," he says. "I have good news. And bad. Bad first. I knew you'd say that." He sets his bundle down and begins to unwrap it. "Bad news. The Commandant has arrived. Coffs, Orcs have started digging graves. From what I heard, not a single scholar prisoner will be spared." My elation at being able to disappear evaporates. "Skies," I say. "What of those people?" "We should try to save them. It's such a mad idea that I know better than to speak it aloud to Keenan." "They'll begin tomorrow evening," he says. "At sundown."
"Darren
is going to be fine. Because we're going to get him out before then. I know a way in. And I stole these." He lifts a pile of black cloth from the bundle. Cough uniforms. "Burgled them from a storage outbuilding. We won't fool anyone up close," he says. "But if we can keep far enough away from prying eyes, we can use them to get in."
"How will we know where Darren is?" I ask. "The prison is enormous, and once we're inside, how will we move around?"
He pulls another pile of cloth from the bundle, this one dingier. I hear the clink of slaves' cuffs. "We change," he says.
"My face is all over the Empire," I say. "What if I'm recognized? Or what if..."
"Liar," Keenan says patiently. "You have to trust me."
"Maybe," I hesitate, wondering if he'll be upset.
"Don't be stupid, liar."
"Maybe we won't need the uniforms. I know you said not to, but I tried the disappearing again. And I've got it."
I pause for his reaction, but he only waits for me to go on.
"I figured it out," I clarify. "I can disappear. I can hold it."
"Show me."
I frown, having expected something from him. Perhaps anger or excitement. But then, he hasn't seen what I can do. He's only seen my failure. I close my eyes and keep my inner voice clear and calm. But yet again, I fail. 10 minutes after I begin, I open my eyes. Keenan, waiting calmly, simply shrugs.
I don't doubt that it works some of the time. The kindness in his voice only frustrates me. But it's not reliable. We can't stake Darren's life on it. Once Darren is free, toy with it all you want. For now. Leave it alone.
But
think about the past few weeks. Keenan fidgets, but doesn't pull his gaze away. Whatever he's about to say, he steeled himself for it.
If we'd broken away from Elias and Izzy, like I'd suggested, Elias's tribe would have been safe. And just before the raid on Afia's camp,
it's not that I didn't want to help the scholars. I did. But we should have thought about what would happen as a result. We didn't. And Izzy died.
He says we. I know he means you. My face feels hot. How dare he throw my failures in my face as if I'm a schoolchild to be reprimanded. But he's not wrong, is he? Every time I needed to make a decision, I chose wrong. Disaster after disaster. My hand goes to my armlet, but it feels cold. Hollow. Lawyer, I haven't cared about anyone in a very long time. Keenan puts his hands on my arms. I don't have family like you do. I don't have anyone. Or anything. He traces a finger along my armlet, and a sudden weariness suffuses his movements. You're all I have. Please, my intent is not to be cruel. I simply don't want anything to happen to you, or to the people who care for you.
He must be wrong. The disappearing is at my fingertips. I can feel it. If only I could figure out what's blocking me. If I could remove that one obstacle, it would change everything.
I force myself to nod and repeat the words he's said to me before, when he's given in.
Your will, then.
I look at the uniforms he's brought, at the resolve in his eyes.
Dawn?
I ask. He nods. Dawn.
Chapter 44. Elias. When the warden enters my cell, his mouth is turned downward, his brow furrowed, as if he's encountered a problem that none of his experiments can solve. After pacing back and forth a few times, he speaks.
You will answer my questions completely and in detail.
He lifts his white blue eyes to me.
Or I will cut off your fingers one by one.
His threats are usually far less blunt. One of the reasons he enjoys extracting secrets is the games he plays as he does so. Whatever he wants of me, he must want it badly.
I know that Darin's sister and Lyre of Serra are one and the same. Tell me, why did you travel with her? Who is she to you? Why do you care for her?
I keep the emotion from my face, but my heart thuds uncomfortably fast.
Why do you want to know?
I want to scream.
What do you want with her?
When I don't immediately answer, the warden takes a knife from his fatigues and spreads my fingers flat against the wall.
I have an offer for you,
I say quickly. He raises his eyebrows. The knife inches from my forefinger.
If you examine the facts, Elias, you'll see that you are in no position to make offers.
I won't need fingers or toes or anything else for much longer, I say. I'm dying. So a deal. I'll answer any question you put to me honestly if you do the same.
The warden appears genuinely mystified.
What information could you possibly use at death's door, Elias? Oh,
he grimaces.
Skies, don't tell me. You want to know who your father is?
I don't care who my father is,
I say. In any case, I'm certain you don't know. The warden shakes his head.
How little faith you have in me. Very well, Elias. Let us play your game. A slight adjustment to the rules, however. I ask all my questions first, and if I'm satisfied with your answers, you may ask me one, and only one, question.
It's a terrible deal, but I have no other options. If Keenan plans to double-cross Lyra on the warden's behalf, I must know why. The warden leans out the cell door and barks at a slave to bring him a chair. A scholar child carries it in, her gaze flitting to me with brief curiosity. I wonder if it's Bee, Tass's friend. At the warden's prompting, I tell him about how Lyra saved me from execution and about how I vowed to help her. When he presses, I tell him that I came to care for her after seeing her at Blackcliff.
But why? Does she possess some peculiar knowledge? Is she, perhaps, gifted with power that is beyond human ken? What specifically makes you value her?
I'd filed away Darren's observations about the warden, but now they come back to me. He was frustrated. It was as if he wasn't quite sure what to ask, as if the questions weren't his to begin with. Or, I realize, as if the warden has no idea why he's even asking the questions. I've only known the girl for a few months, I say. She's smart, brave. The warden sighs and waves a dismissive hand at me.
I do not care for moon-eyed blathering, he says. Think with your rational mind, Elias. Is there anything unusual about her?
She survived the Commandant, I say, impatient now. For a scholar, that's quite unusual. The warden leans back, stroking his chin, gaze far away.
Indeed, he says. How did she survive? Marcus was supposed to have killed her.
He fixes me with an appraising stare. The freezing cell suddenly feels colder.
Tell me about the trial. Exactly what happened in the amphitheater?
It's not the question I expected, but I relate what happened. When I describe Marcus's attack on Lyra, he stops me.
But she survived, he says. How? Hundreds of people saw her die.
The augurs tricked us, I say. One of them took the hit meant for Lyra. Cain named Marcus Victor. In the chaos, his brethren took Lyra away.
And then, the warden says, tell me the rest. Leave nothing out.
I hesitate, because something about this seems wrong. The warden stands, flings open the cell door, and calls for Tass. Footsteps patter, and a second later, he yanks Tass in by the scruff of his neck and puts his knife to the boy's throat.
You are correct when you say that you will soon die, the warden says. This boy, however, is young and relatively healthy. Lie to me, Elias. And I show you his insides while he still lives. Now, I'll say it again. Tell me everything that happened with the girl after the fourth trial.
Forgive me, Lyra, if I give away your secrets. I swear it's not for nothing. I watch the warden carefully as I speak about Lyra's destruction of Blackcliff, our escape from Sarah, and all that happened after. I wait to see if he reacts to my mention of Keenan, but the old man gives no sign that he knows any more about the rebel than what I'm telling him. My gut tells me his disinterest is genuine. What the bleeding hells? Perhaps Keenan isn't working for the Warden. And yet from what Darin told me, it's obvious that they are somehow communicating. Could they both be reporting to someone else? The old man shoves Tess away, and the child cowers on the floor, waiting to be dismissed. But the Warden is deep in thought, methodically filing away relevant facts from the information I've given him. Sensing my gaze, he pulls himself from his musings.
You had a question, Elias.
An interrogator can learn as much from a statement as from a question. My mother's words coming to aid me when I least expect it. The questions you asked Darin about Lyra, I say. You don't know their purpose. Someone else is pulling your strings. I watch the Warden's mouth, for that is where he hides his truths, in twitches of those dry, too thin lips. As I speak, his mouth tightens almost imperceptibly. Got you. Who is it, Warden? The Warden stands so quickly that he knocks his chair over. Tass quickly lugs it out of the cell. My chains loosen when the Warden yanks down the lever on the wall. I answered everything you asked of me, I say. 10 hells. Why am I even trying? I was a fool to think he'd honor his vow. You're not upholding your end of the bargain! The Warden pauses at the cell's threshold, his face half turned toward me, unsmiling. The torchlight in the hallway deepens the grooves in his cheeks and jaw. For a moment, it's as if I can see the stark outline of his skull beneath.
That's because you asked who it is, Elias, the Warden says. Instead of what?
Chapter 45. Liar. Like so many nights before this one, rest is elusive. Keenan sleeps beside me, arm thrown across my hip, his forehead tipped down against my shoulder. His quiet breathing almost lulls me into dreams, but every time I get close, I jerk awake and fret anew. Does Darin live? If so, and if I can save him, how will we make it to Marin? Will Spiro be waiting there, as he promised? Will Darin even want to make weapons for the scholars? What of Elias? Helene might already have him. Or he might be dead, destroyed by the poison coursing through his body. If he does live, I do not know if Keenan will help me save him. But I must save him, and I cannot leave the other scholars either. I cannot abandon them to be executed in the Commandant's purge. They'll begin tomorrow evening, at sundown, Keenan said of the executions. A bloody gloaming then, and bloodier still as twilight fades to night. I ease Keenan's arm away and roll to my feet, pulling on my cloak and boots and slipping out into the cold night. A nagging dread steals over me. Keenan's plan is as unknowable as the inside of Koff itself. His confidence offers some reassurance, but not enough to make me feel like we will succeed. Something about all of this just feels wrong. Rushed. Liar. Keenan emerges from the cave, his red hair mussed, making him look younger. He offers his hand, and I wind my fingers through his, taking comfort from his touch. What a change a few months has wrought in him. I could not have imagined such a smile from the dark-visaged fighter I first met in Sarah. Keenan looks at me and frowns. You're nervous. I sigh. I cannot leave Elias. Skies, I hope I'm not wrong again. I hope that pushing this, fighting for it, doesn't lead to some other disaster. An image of Keenan lying dead floats through my mind, and I fight back a shudder. Elias would do it for you, and going into Koff is a terrible risk, no matter what. I will not leave him. The rebel tilts his head, his eyes on the snow. I hold my breath.
Then we must find a way to get him out, he says. Though, it will take longer. Thank you, I lean into him, breathing in wind and fire and warmth. It's the right thing to do, I know it is. I feel the familiar pattern of my armlet against my palm and realize that, as ever, my hand has drifted to it for comfort. Keenan watches me, his eyes strange, lonely. What is it like to have something of your family's? It makes me feel close to them, I say. It gives me strength. He reaches out, almost touching the armlet, but then self-consciously dropping his hand. It's good to remember those who are lost, to have a reminder in the dark times. His voice is soft. It's good to know that you were, are, loved. My eyes fill. Keenan has never spoken of his family other than to tell me that they are gone. At least I had a family. He has had nothing, and no one. My fingers tighten on my armlet, and on impulse, I pull it off. At first, it is as if it doesn't want to come off, but I give it a good yank, and it releases. I'll be your family now, I whisper, opening Keenan's hands and placing the armlet on his palm. I close his fingers around it. Not a mother, father, brother, or sister, perhaps, but family nonetheless. He breathes in sharply, staring down at the armlet. His brown eyes are opaque, and I wish I knew what he felt. But I allow him his silence. He pulls the armlet onto his wrist with slow reverence. A chasm opens up inside me as if the last bit of my family is gone. But I take comfort from the way Keenan looks at the armlet, as if it's the most precious thing he's ever been given. He turns to me and rests his hands on my waist, closing his eyes, leaning his head against mine. Why? He whispers. Why? Did you give it to me? Because you are loved, I say. You're not alone. And you deserve to know that. Look at me, he murmurs. When I do, I flinch, pained to see his eyes so anguished, haunted, like he's seeing something he doesn't wish to accept. But a moment later his expression changes, hardens. His hands, gentle a moment ago, tighten and grow warm. Too warm. The irises of his eyes brighten. I see myself reflected within, and then I feel as if I'm falling into a nightmare. A scream claws its way out of my throat, for in Keenan's eyes I see ruin, failure, death. Darren's mangled body, Elias turning away from me, impassive as he disappears into an ancient forest, an army of fiery, enraged faces advancing. The Commandant standing over me, drawing her blade across my throat in one clean, deadly stroke. Keenan, I gasp. What? My name. His voice changes as he speaks, his warmth souring, twisting into something foul and grating. Is not Keenan. He jerks his fingers away, and his head is flung back as if by an otherworldly fist. His mouth opens in a silent howl, the muscles of his forearms and neck bulging. A cloud of darkness breaks over us both, knocking me back. Keenan! I cannot make out the crisp whiteness of the snow or the undulating lights in the sky. I lash out blindly at whatever attacks us. I can't see anything. All is obscured until the blackness curls back from the edges of my vision, slowly resolving into a hooded figure with malevolent suns for eyes. I take hold of a nearby tree trunk and grab for my knife. I know this figure. The last I saw him, he was hissing orders at the woman who frightens me most in this world. Nightbringer. My body trembles. I feel as though some hand has taken me by my core and now squeezes, waiting to see when I will break. What in the bleeding skies did you do with Keenan, you monster? I must be mad to scream at him so, but the creature only laughs, impossibly low, like boulders grinding beneath a black sea.
There was no Keenan, Liar of Sarah, the Nightbringer says. There was only ever me.
Lies! I clutch my knife,
but the hilt burns hot as fresh-forged steel, and I drop it with a yelp.